Professor Caroline Levine joined the UW-Madison Department of English in 2002. She earned her PhD at the University of London and her undergraduate degree at Princeton University. She's a specialist in Victorian literature and culture, as well as a specialist on arts policy and the relations between art, politics, law, and democracy. And she'll be sharing some interesting cases with us today. She's a member of the editorial team of the Norton Anthology of World Literature, which all the former English majors out there probably recall lugging around their Norton anthologies. Her first book, The Serious Pleasures of Suspense, won the prestigious Perkins Prize in 2004. She's co-edited several essay collections. And in her latest book, Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts, Caroline Levine challenges traditional ideas about the role of art and artists in a democratic society. And that's the topic she'll be discussing with us today. She will, if as time permits, be willing to take a few questions at the end of her talk. So please join me in welcoming Professor Caroline Levine.
Hi, and welcome on this gorgeous Tuesday. I'm glad it's a little chilly so that people want to be inside rather than outside. I just want to start by saying that literally not a day goes by in my life when I don't feel incredibly grateful for the chance to work at the University of Wisconsin. So as an undergraduate myself, I chose to go to Princeton, and I've worked at or studied at Rutgers and Yale and Dartmouth. Nowhere else that I've ever been have my colleagues been so committed to thinking about why we do what we do, what it's good for, how we can serve a broad public. Nowhere else have people really understood the value of resources so that we work as hard as we can to do great things with what we've got, whether it's good times or bad times. And nowhere else have I had a greater sense of what's possible. So our students, our faculty, our administrators, and of course our loyal and generous alumni believe that this is and always will be a world-class university. And every day, together, we make that the reality that the world does recognize. So I want to thank you not only for being here today to listen to me talk about some of my research, but also for helping me to make my friends who teach at Yale and Columbia and Michigan feel jealous when I talk to them about what we do here at the University of Wisconsin. Now, I've always felt that it's important to justify what we do at the university to a broad public. And it's part of the reason I really appreciate the Wisconsin idea as very special, very unusual. But it's not always easy to justify the arts. For many people, the arts are just a frill, and, you know, when it's time for budget cuts, that's what goes first. So I've always had a hunch that the arts are more than a frill, but the question has been, why do we need them? What are they for? The question is especially important for the humanities disciplines, including philosophy, literature, art history, and anthropology, where we think about the making of meaning in human communities. So if art is really crucial to the making of meaning itself, then clearly we can't really do without it. But how do we talk about its value? How do we talk about what it really is worth? So for myself, I've always been interested in thinking about the ways that people in lots of different parts of society talk about the arts. So not just professors, but how do journalists, politicians, ordinary people, people in different classes of society, how do they talk about the arts? What do they mean to them? And about a dozen years ago, I started to try to track the ways that ordinary people talk about why the arts matter. And I found that there was particularly fruitful supply of arguments and debates in public arguments, like debates over public funding for the arts, or debates that come up in obscenity trials, or fears about propaganda. So I started to get immersed in these debates and to teach them to my students. And before I got really involved in these debates, I thought I was going to hear 100 different definitions of art and 100 different reasons why art would matter. But I ended up really surprised by what I discovered. What I found was that the same fundamental idea kept shaping every single debate I came upon, from the US to Poland to India, from the end of the 19th century to the beginning of the 21st. Every single case ultimately, not always explicitly, but ultimately revolved around the same paradoxical relationship between art and democracy. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. I'm going to tell you one version of the paradox to start out with, and then I will keep coming back to it as I go on. So it was sort of a strange conclusion. It was not the conclusion I intended to come to in my book. I came to believe that democracies don't just need art. If we're going to be free societies, we need art. We urgently need art that the majority does not particularly like or want. So, some of the works I discuss in my book include Jackson Pollock's drip paintings, Jeff Koons's String of Puppies, James Joyce's Ulysses, the performance art of Karen Finley, this protest poster, this painting by Indian artist Surendran Nair, and the popular country music of the Dixie Chicks. Not too many people like all of these, nor should we. But I'd like to tell you some stories today to persuade you that we really, really need all of these because we don't like all of them. We can't have a vibrant, healthy, truly free democracy without them. So, we're used to hearing that democracies are the best atmosphere for artists to work in, right? Artists need the kind of freedom that's not possible in totalitarian states like Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or Afghanistan under the Taliban. But I want to start by telling you a story that's about the fact that democracies are not always good atmospheres for artists. This is the story of Richard Serra's Tilted Arc, a long, curving steel wall that was installed in a federal plaza in downtown Manhattan in 1981. Art critics said this was one of the most important sculptural works of the late 20th century. But immediately, complaints started to stream in. Hundreds and hundreds of complaints, a lot of them from workers in the adjacent federal building. What bothered people was the intimidating bulk of the sculpture, its strangeness, its ugliness, and people started to get up petitions to get it torn down. So one petition had 1,300 signatures, and altogether there were 4,500 letters and appeals that were sent to the federal government, both for and against tearing this sculpture down. In 1985, a government panel decided to destroy the sculpture. Here you can see the teams bulldozing it in the middle of the night. The panel that decided to take it down claimed that the most important element in their decision was a democratic vote. They cited Manhattan Community Board Number 1, a body which represents more than 250,000 residents in Lower Manhattan, which had voted 22-0 to tear down the sculpture. So literally speaking, a democratic majority had torn down a work of art. Now, on the face of it, that's fair enough, right? The people in that neighborhood don't like it, so why do they have to live with it? But not everyone is represented by the local community. And so in the hearing, there was a lot of talk of, what about visitors? What about the future? One artist in the hearing said, 100 years from now, such work will elicit praise from posterity. So the final decision about Tilted Arc was made in the name of democracy, but it's a pretty limited conception of democracy. It's only the local community and the contemporary majority, that is, the here and the now. So there's no room in this concept of democracy for the possibility of a changing public, one that will grow out of its current tastes and values. Now, this case, which you may well have heard about, it was a huge disaster for the relationship between the art world on the one hand and a sense of how you build artworks in public places and so democratic decision-making processes on the other hand. And since then, lots of people have argued that communities should have a lot more say in what art goes up before it goes up to kind of forestall these sorts of disasters. But this has its own disadvantages. In the late 1980s, Congress decided to honor veterans of the Korean War with a new memorial. A jury of 10 Korean War veterans chose a winning design, and I don't have a photo of it because, as you'll see in a moment, why not? So this is just a photo of some Korean warriors at the time. The initial proposal was supposed to show 38 soldiers moving across a field, looking peaceful, as though their work as warriors was done, and they were going home, having done their work. They're on their way home. A group of retired military officers who run the American Battle Monuments Commission objected to this design. They said, soldiers deserve more glory than this. They should be looking battle-ready, heroic, prepared for danger. At this point, six other federal agencies and commissions got involved in the dispute, finding fault with both of the original proposals. The end result was a compromise that no one liked very much. 7-foot-tall sculpted soldiers who are wearing full battle gear, but underneath ponchos, so they don't look too militaristic. One committee member said it looked like a football game in the rain. Now, of course, many people are glad that there's some kind of memorial to what is often known as the Forgotten War. But as a memorial, this one is not nearly as successful as Maya Lin's famous Vietnam War Memorial, which was considered, it was extremely controversial when it was first unveiled, and a lot of veterans themselves said that they hated it and rejected it, but within just a few years, it became much, much beloved. So the lesson of the Korean War Memorial seems to be that art should not be made by committee. But that means we're kind of stuck, because if we leave choices about art in the hands of artists, they're going to disappoint or frustrate or alienate communities. But if we leave choices about art to democratic decision-making processes, we're going to get bad art. This reminds me of a paradox I kept running into the whole time I was doing my research. On the one hand, you would hear people say, art is for everyone, it's universal. And on the other hand, just about as often, you'd hear people say, well, if everyone likes it, it must be mediocre. So is art for the few, or is it for the many? And that turned out to be the question that drove every single controversy I looked into, including, to my surprise, obscenity trials. So I looked at a whole bunch of obscenity cases, and I assumed, as I think most people would assume, that obscenity trials would revolve around sexual taboos and questions about sexuality. But it turned out that all of them also hinged on the question of democracy. Let me tell you a story of an obscenity case that happened in New York in 1887. Some of you may have heard of Anthony Comstock, who's here on the right. He was famous for campaigning against smut. He founded the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, and he joined the post office so that he could make sure that pornography was not being sent through the mails. In 1887, he set up a trap to catch an eminent Fifth Avenue art dealer named Hermann Nödler. Nödler's gallery was selling paintings of nudes from Paris. When he was caught, Nödler said he was outraged that he would be a target, and he defended himself, saying that his customers, quote, were among the most refined and intelligent people in the country. But the thing is, Nödler wasn't only selling paintings. He was also selling cheap photographic reproductions of paintings, like this one. And that was the problem. Comstock said he wasn't singling out Nödler's usual clientele, the ones who bought the expensive paintings. What he was worried about were the people who bought the photographs. These photographs I have seized, sir, are not works of art. They are sold wholesale at 50 cents a piece to small dealers. A grand oil painting with its massive coloring, its artistic surroundings, its grand shadings and streaks of light, all of which create a work of art, ceases to be such when presented in a photograph, which gives mere outlines of form, and that is all. Again, let me add, if you please, that the very cost of art precludes it from being gaped at, stared at by the masses who have no conception of the grandeur of the merits of such a work, and would, if they had a chance, merely admire the bare nudity, if you so call it, without letting their minds or their eyes, even if they could, rest upon the grand surroundings. So one of the things that interested me right away here is that both sides actually share a fundamental assumption about elites, which is that it's no problem if elites are looking at images of nudes. So Noedler says his clients are too refined to be accused of indecency. Comstock agrees. He says, I'm not worried about your usual clients. The problem is the unthinking masses who can't afford or appreciate great art. So the real difference was whether it was good or bad for these kinds of images to reach ordinary people. Comstock's argument was that it was bad because when photos crossed class lines, they cheapened the art such that it could no longer be grand or dignified. And Noedler's side responded that it was a great thing if these works of high art crossed class lines. That was of educational benefit to a wide society. So the surprise here for me was that the central question in this trial wasn't, is it art? What's good art? What's bad art? What's the line between art and pornography? But rather, what kind of culture should be allowed to reach everyone? So it was basically the democratization of culture that was at stake. Now, in the course of my research, one of the things I discovered was that obscenity law always revolved around this question: what kind of culture should reach everyone? So the first obscenity prosecutions in the U.S. and Europe don't happen until toward the end of the 19th century. I was really surprised by that. I had assumed that there had been obscenity prosecutions going back centuries. But no, it's in the 1860s and 1870s and 1880s that you first have people prosecuted for obscenity. So I tried to figure out, why was that true? Why at that time in particular? Well, it's a time, as I learned from a number of historians, of a huge expansion in education and technology, which allowed a huge mass audience access to books and pictures for the first time. So by 1880, almost everybody in Europe can read, for example, for the first time ever. Then there's cheap technology that produces photographs and books at a price that ordinary people can get their hands on. So for the first time, you have a cheap and widely distributed mass culture. So this is the first moment when just about everybody can get their hands on pictures and books. This produced a lot of anxiety. If you can see this, this is a cartoon from that shows this anxiety. These are the dangers that come from letting anybody go into a bookstore. You've got a fight going on the left. You've got a woman who doesn't know what she's doing, but she's being gaped at by another man who doesn't even realize the books are falling on his head. And then down in the bottom right, you have a young man who's stealing a book. So tremendous anxiety about what happens when poor and working class people can get their hands on culture. That's the moment when people start to feel anxious about what kind of culture people have access to, and that's when they start calling for new restrictions, like obscenity law. So obscenity law revolves around the question of democracy in the sense that culture has just gotten democratized. There's more access for more people, and the question then becomes, what's the right kind of art for a democratic society? Now, lots and lots of people have argued, both then and now, that the best way to answer that question is just to leave it up to the marketplace. People want to buy art, they can buy it. There's no need for the government ever to get involved. And there's definitely something to that argument. But if we leave our culture just up to our wallets, we get what's often called mass culture, culture that appeals to the largest number of people. Here's a mob trying to get in to see Elvis, and you can see the words are cut off, but the most talked about personality up above. And then for a more recent example, here's Britney Spears in front of her crowd of fans. Now, scholars have argued that the burst of mass culture that happened at the end of the 19th century and continues into our own time has been both good and bad for democracy. It's been a kind of double-edged sword. On the one hand, having a common culture allows a big, diverse nation like ours to feel connected. So if we're all reading the same news stories and watching the same TV shows, we have a kind of common social glue that holds us together. But mass culture also brings dangers with it. If everyone is reading and seeing the same cultural material, there's a threat that we'll become too homogeneous. We'll start to go towards the lowest common denominator or the middle of the road. And that means that people who don't fit the mainstream may never get to speak at all. So political philosophers like Alexis de Tocqueville or John Stuart Mill worried that this would produce a tyranny of the majority that would be more repressive than power-hungry kings and governments, and that we should worry about it actually more than we worry about the centralization of power in the hands of a few people. So I want to tell you another story which helped to persuade me how dangerous the tyranny of the majority could be in a democracy. This story comes from 1925. A sculptor named Jacob Epstein, who was a Jewish American guy, was commissioned to do a frieze, that is a two-dimensional sculptural work, for London's Hyde Park. And he depicted Rima, a mythological character from William Henry Hudson's Green Mansion. Some of you may know that novel. He had originally wanted to do a portrait of William Henry Hudson, but apparently you're not allowed to have portraits of non-royal people in Hyde Park. So it was okay to have a fictional character, but not a real person. So this is his frieze to Rima. All over the British Isles, people were outraged by this work. There were 200 letters and articles in national newspapers in 1925 alone. There were petitions to move or destroy the sculpture, and there were even two debates in the House of Commons about what to do. Now, we're used to thinking about artists who upset people on the grounds of religion or sex or politics, but Epstein's work didn't present any of these problems, according to the people who were really angry about it. The problem, according to his critics, was that his artistic style wasn't English enough. One letter to the Times complained that Rima was, quote, grotesquely out of harmony with a typically English public park. The Morning Post called the work hideous, unnatural, un-English, and essentially unhealthy. This sense that the work was wrong for traditional England grew and grew. Eventually, three times, a group that called itself the Independent Fascist League scrawled anti-Semitic epithets on it in green paint, which I'm happy to say they've cleaned off. Even the more mainstream Saturday Review, which was a kind of a mainstream magazine, wrote, "Nearly all the support for violence rather than beauty in art comes from socialists, foreigners, and Jews." So Epstein's work was attacked because his style was strange and foreign. And that meant that it kind of flaunted the fact that he himself was a foreigner, an American, and a Jew. And this meant that the press could whip up wide support for attacking, defacing, and removing this sculpture from the public sphere. So we're used to thinking of democracies as free societies, but democracies are organized around majorities, and majorities are capable of this kind of nationalism and jingoism, whipping up a kind of sentiment that's so strong that there's an active desire to drive out minority expression. So the sobering lesson of the Rima scandal, I think, is the idea that popular opinion in a democracy can take its place on a continuum with fascism. That is, majority rule can turn into that fascist impulse to suppress outsiders and foreigners altogether. And it's here, I think, that we can start to see how artists have an especially valuable role to play in democratic societies. So in the late 19th century, at the same time that there's this huge expansion in mass culture, it was artists, more than anyone else, who started worrying about the tyranny of the majority. Small groups of artists deliberately rejected mass culture and this notion of a mainstream. They saw it as pressuring the public into becoming more and more homogeneous, less and less open to different views and perspectives. They wanted instead to make us uncomfortable, critical. They wanted to make us ask questions instead of just being passive consumers and letting culture kind of wash over us. They claimed that the only artworks that were worth anything were those that were unpopular, unfamiliar, and above all, new. These groups call themselves artists of the avant-garde, and the term avant-garde is originally taken from a military context, meaning the front line or the vanguard. And so you can imagine these artists thinking that they're doing battle with mainstream culture in the name of the future. Now, the avant-gardes are associated with a series of famous movements: Impressionism, Fauvism, Cubism, Surrealism, lots of isms, Suprematism. Jacob Epstein was himself an avant-garde sculptor, and so he thought of himself as challenging the public by working in a style that was unfamiliar and difficult. And of course, he did challenge them. He challenged them so much that the public actually wanted him to be removed altogether from the public sphere. You can think about how artists of the avant-garde were working in a huge range of different styles. They were working, none of their paintings or sculptures ended up looking like each other, but all of them were asking the same question. That is not, am I making something that people will like? But instead, am I pushing at the limits of what we already know? Am I unsettling perspectives? Am I challenging audiences to see in a wholly new way? Now, in the past century, avant-garde artists upset people at both ends of the political spectrum. The first story I want to tell you is about Emil Nolde, who's one of the first German expressionist painters. So he works in very lurid colors and exaggerated forms. He happened to be a fervent German nationalist, an anti-Semite, and a voluntary member of the Nazi Party from the 1920s. He became one of Goebbels' favorite painters in the 1930s. But because his artwork involved experimenting on the front lines of style, because he was distorting and exaggerating color and form, the Nazis actually hated his artwork. And they put it in the degenerate art show, and this is my favorite part of it, they forbade him ever to paint again, including in private. So despite the fact that he's a fervent German nationalist and Nazi, he is not allowed to paint for the Nazis because he's too avant-garde. Let me give you a second example. This second example is Vsevolod Meyerhold, who was a passionate Bolshevik. He was a theater director, and he thought that his experimental and forward-looking art was going to be part of the revolution. He really believed in the Russian Revolution, and he thought, this is a stage set for one of his plays, he thought that by experimenting on the front lines of culture, he would help to usher in a truly revolutionary society. But his style upset Stalin so much that Stalin had him tortured and executed in prison in 1940. So again, the problem was not religion, sex, or politics. The problem was his style. So from these two examples, you can see that the avant-garde upset both extremes in the 20th century. But I think if we think back to the Rima case, we can see that the avant-garde upset democracies too. So right, left, and center, everyone was bothered by the artist's refusal to conform to common or to traditional styles and tastes. And this is where I see the artist's real value. Artists act as society's needlers. They're constantly testing the boundaries, asking what the limits of our sense of inclusiveness really are. They're always asking the question, what can't we see or understand if we just go along with majority views? That still seems like an urgent problem to me. Does our democracy produce an oppressive sense of majority culture, or does it embrace and encourage voices that are strange, foreign, unfamiliar, or challenging? And if we're closing out challenging and unfamiliar perspectives, are we losing something really valuable? My favorite champion of this view is Václav Havel, former president of the Czech Republic and practicing playwright. He said, There are those around the world, indeed even those in democracies with the longest tradition of free speech and expression, who would attempt to limit the artist to what is acceptable, conventional, comfortable. They are unwilling to take the risks that real creativity entails. But an artist must challenge, must controvert the established order. To limit that creative spirit in the name of public sensibility is to deny society one of its most significant resources. So on the one hand, this view may sound relatively familiar. Artists are there to challenge us, to make us uncomfortable, to make us think in new ways. But it actually has a pretty paradoxical set of implications for thinking about democracies. We need the arts precisely when we don't like them, when we resist them, when they provoke us into some kind of unsettled response. So in this view, art is, and I find this really strange, both for the few and for the many. It's for the few in the sense that it should come from an unfamiliar perspective that doesn't please the majority of us. But these artistic experiments, these disruptions, are good for everyone because they keep our democracies open and dynamic. They compel us to accommodate eccentric and dissenting styles, tastes, and beliefs. Now, to my mind, this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately. This idea connects up with the Wisconsin idea in some ways that both trouble me and inspire me. The university sometimes, like the arts, seems to the people of the state of Wisconsin to be disconnected from what people want. But fundamental to the business of the university is this idea that we don't just give the majority back what they already know or already like or already feel comfortable with. We are actually required as research faculty to produce new knowledge, knowledge that isn't familiar. And this is the value at the very heart of the University of Wisconsin's mission. And I'm going to quote the phrase that everybody, all of you have heard so many times, you can recite it in your sleep. We believe the great state University of Wisconsin should ever encourage that continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth can be found. So I think there's always the danger that not only artists, but also scholars, faculty in a university like this one, will seem like elitists, outsiders, foreigners who are out of touch with popular taste. But I've been persuaded increasingly by this strange, paradoxical idea that the majority always benefits from challenges to itself. So how do we persuade the majority, say of the state of Wisconsin, of the importance of what we do if part of our job is to resist the majority? I think it's hard to both serve the state and to challenge it, but I really don't think it's impossible. Something specific I learned while I was doing my research is that some of the deepest values we hold as a society are actually in tension with one another. Specifically, there's an ongoing tension between freedom on the one hand and democracy on the other. And if you listen to our politicians, those two words mean the same thing and you can use them interchangeably. But I learned that is not the case at all. So I think art can help us to see why we all need to be challenged if we're going to live in a free democracy. So I'm going to tell you another story to illustrate this point. In the late 1940s, U.S. Cold War strategists were feeling kind of frustrated because the Soviet Union was seeming to be winning the propaganda war. One of the things the Soviets kept saying was that the U.S. was a shallow and materialist nation, and the only culture that the U.S. could produce was false and glitzy matinee idols. So I got you a picture of some matinee idols. U.S. diplomats thought that this might be true. They were worried about the increasingly widespread global perception, quote, that other countries send us art and we send them machinery. So strategists started to call for an effort at cultural diplomacy that would showcase the amazing ways that America embraced great artists, writers, and intellectuals and allowed them to thrive in an atmosphere of unparalleled freedom. But the U.S. wasn't actually doing a very good job at being a society of unparalleled freedom. Here's the poet Langston Hughes testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he and, as you know, many other artists, including Bertolt Brecht, Paul Robeson, Ayn Rand, and Arthur Miller, all testified. about their political commitments. An especially embarrassing episode happened in 1947. The State Department had sponsored a traveling exhibit of modern American painters, including Arshile Gorky, Robert Motherwell, and Georgia O'Keeffe. The show was called Advancing American Art, and it had been touring Eastern Europe and Latin America as part of the battle for the hearts and minds of people in unaligned nations. So far, it had been a huge success. There were a bunch of reports that suggested that audiences in Latin America and Eastern Europe were surprised that the United States was capable of such experimental, surprising cultural production, and that this was actually making them think that this is a freer society than they had thought. So this show, and this is one of the paintings from the show, seemed to be proof of democracy's capacity to accommodate free spirits. There were plans to take the show to Guatemala, Iran, and Cambodia. But before the show could travel too far, Congress and the press found out that these were the paintings that were representing America overseas. The paintings were called left-wing, subversive, and alien. One congressman from Mississippi said, "No American drew these crazy pictures." And another argued that the only appropriate art to send abroad was portraits of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. Public pressure forced the State Department to cancel the show. The works were sold off at a 95% discount. So this is Jacob Lawrence's Harlem, which one lucky buyer got for $13.93. I understand that 3 years ago, one of his paintings sold for $2.5 million. So that was a great investment. Excuse me. The cancellation of the show was a huge blow to this effort at cultural diplomacy. It was hard to prove that the democratic West was a free, open, creative society when there was majority resistance like this to experimental art. So U.S. strategists started to craft a whole new cultural diplomacy behind the scenes. The newly formed CIA decided to promote avant-garde art as a covert instrument of geopolitical warfare. At the time, Jackson Pollock was one of a loosely affiliated group of artists who came to be known as the Abstract Expressionists. Now, Pollock was stereotypically American, unlike some of the artists who were actually immigrants in the Advancing American Art Show and drew criticism just on the basis of the fact that they didn't seem like Americans. Pollock drank and swaggered like a cowboy. He was born in Wyoming. He seemed really American. In his early life, he actually had Marxist sympathies, and he made art for a Communist Party rally. But in the late 40s, he turned away from traditional representational art to avant-garde abstraction. And most notoriously, he introduced his shocking new signature method, drip painting. The CIA saw in Pollock a way to prove the Soviets wrong. Defiant and challenging, staggeringly original and unconventional, Pollock proved that America wasn't all mass culture and Hollywood glitz. Pollock had actually been widely mocked and criticized by the press, and this was actually good from the CIA's point of view. Pollock proved to the world that no matter how much the majority disliked a particular style of art, America was still hospitable. You could still thrive in our context. Pollock was also proof that the U.S. was taking a different road from the Soviets, who were insisting on a specific artistic style, which came to be known as socialist realism. Quite unlike socialist realism, Jack the Dripper, as the press came to call him, showed that the U.S. let the strangest and most popular art flourish. These days, the CIA's role in the cultural life in the 40s and 50s is widely known, but at the time, they kept their operations secret. They set up false foundations to fund modern art so that neither the artists nor the public would know that the government was supporting this extreme and radical work. Through front organizations, they funded concerts, performances, and art exhibitions worldwide to glorify U.S. artistic production. So Pollock's case helps me to point to this. It's, of course, amazing that the CIA got involved in art, but it helps me to think about this paradox that I keep coming to. If the U.S. was going to persuade the world to choose democracy, it was going to do so by bypassing democratic processes. In order to encourage openness, said one member of the CIA later, we had to be secret. And they weren't the only hypocrites involved. So while the CIA is undermining democracy in the name of democracy, Congress is undermining freedom in the name of freedom. The lesson here is not just that people tend to be hypocritical, although that may also be true, but there's an important lesson from political theory, which has been around for a long, long time, and that is the idea that democracy and freedom are not the same thing, and in fact, they can be very much at odds, especially in wartime. So if in wartime a strong united nation, a democracy that's powerfully united is your priority, then you probably want to squelch dissenting voices and say, look, we're a united front. If freedom is your priority, you probably want to be open to dissenting voices, even anti-war voices, but that might undermine the strength of a national majority. Now, both Congress and the CIA went around saying that they were holding up both freedom and democracy as values, but I think the Cold War makes it clear how hard it is to hold on to both of those values at the same time. So Congress betrayed freedom in the name of a strong democracy, and the CIA circumvented democracy in the name of freedom. So together, these two arms, the government, Congress and the CIA, worked against each other to produce a kind of surprisingly effective propaganda machine. To my knowledge, only one major figure in the Cold War seems to have stood on both sides of the fence, supporting both the national majority and artistic freedom. Richard Nixon first made his name as an aggressive young member of the House Un-American Activities Committee. He took the campaign against artists, in particular, to a new extreme in the 1940s when he insisted on removing all art in government buildings that was inconsistent, quote, with American ideas and principles. So whatever was already up, he wanted to re-examine. However, by the 10th of December, 1969, Richard Nixon had completely changed his tune. Now President of the United States, he sent a special message to Congress arguing for the importance of federal support for the arts. The growth of the arts is vital to our national well-being. America has moved to the forefront as a place of creative expression. The excellence of the American product in the arts has won worldwide recognition. Our creative and performing artists give free and full expression to the American spirit as they illuminate, criticize, and celebrate our civilization. And Nixon was actually right here. Thanks in part to the CIA, American artists had by this time gained worldwide recognition as at the forefront of creative expression, and partly for their critical perspectives. And Nixon also put his money where his mouth was. So to the shock and horror of his fellow Republicans and many conservative Democrats, Nixon's first year in office marked a dramatic rise in federal arts funding, and he just got more and more extravagant the longer he was in office. So he doubled, tripled, and then quadrupled funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. Now, on the face of it, this seems kind of puzzling. How does he go from being totally anti-art to being totally, excessively pro-art? I think it's kind of like the fact that he was the only president who could go to China and escape being labeled soft on communism. Because of his HUAC red-baiting past, he could support the arts without seeming like a left-leaning, soft intellectual who was out of touch with popular taste. So when he was part of the House Un-American Activities Committee, he stood for a strong, unified, democratic majority. Then, when he turned into a generous patron of the arts, he promoted the challenging voices of a dissenting freedom. So, strange as it might seem, and covert and problematic in all kinds of ways, it still turned out that challenging uncomfortable art was surprisingly important art for a democracy. When the press and Congress protested against this crazy avant-garde stuff, they made art seem like an enemy of the majority. But being against the majority was precisely what allowed artists to seem like examples of freedom from majority rule. So looking back over all these cases, we might still ask why we need artists now today. A lot of artists are no longer working in avant-garde styles, don't consider themselves part of the avant-garde. Legal theorist Cass Sunstein, some of you may know his work. I love this book, Republic.com. I really recommend it. This is a book that gave me a lot to think about. Sunstein argues that we need to worry about collective life now, especially in the age of the internet. And he points out that if you're surfing the web, you can read views and perspectives that you've chosen in advance, so you don't have to come across views and ideas that you don't want to come across. So if you're a liberal, you read liberal websites. If you're a conservative, you read conservative websites. And you filter out views that you don't care about. So the internet tends to reinforce views that we already have and is creating more and more division, Sunstein suggests. He says it's really important for all of us to be exposed to unfamiliar, uncomfortable, even irritating voices, a whole range of viewpoints, if we're going to figure out how to live together. Artists, and this is my argument, not Sunstein's, seem really crucial in this respect, because as long as artists see themselves as constantly pushing us to think new thoughts, to see in new ways, they force us to recognize that our comfortable, familiar ways of seeing and feeling are not the only ways to think and see and feel. Sunstein argues it's really enriching for all of us to have dissenting ideas around, and he has a whole bunch of examples, and one of them, he argues that corporations that encourage dissent on their boards actually do better in terms of profits than ones that insist on a single majority viewpoint. Sunstein also points to a favorite psychology experiment of mine, which you may know about. An individual, the subject of the experiment, was put in a room full of people and asked to look at two lines, and one was clearly longer than the other one. The psychologist asked a whole group for a show of hands in answer to the two questions, is one line longer than the other, or are they the same length? The subject didn't realize that the rest of the crowd were plants who'd been told to raise their hands when the psychologist asked, are they the same length? So the question is asked. The subject thinks the two lines are different, but then sees everybody else around him raising their hands to answer the question, the two lines are the same length. And over and over again, the subject raises her hand to go along with the majority, even against the evidence of her own eyes. So what's dangerous here is not that democracy is bad or wrong in itself. I would never argue such a thing. But that too strong an embrace of majority rule always runs the risk of authoritarianism. That is, the willingness to silence dissent in favor of a single majority view. For the sake of the Wisconsin idea and other invaluable democratic projects, I think it's really crucial for us to think about and talk about bridges between freedom and democracy. So to honor majority rule, but also to talk to a larger public about how it's in all of our interests to be provoked, unsettled, challenged, sometimes even shocked or irritated. So it's important for us all to think about how the fearless process of sifting and winnowing may be of benefit to everyone. And art, as I've been saying, has a particularly valuable role to play in this. Democracies have needed artists since the late 19th century because they've made it their job to stand outside of those homogenizing machines of mass culture. And I think we do still need them. Democracies, by definition, always face the threat that majority rule will lead to the suppression of minority voices. So strange and uncomfortable avant-garde art protects democracy from one of its own worst enemies, itself. Thank you.